up and welcome back to an episode of Sharp Stats, the Talking Yanks Boys, myself, John Boy, and only fitting that we are joined by a queen after the London series, the queen of stats, KT Sharp. And we are recording before the first of two against the Metropolitan, so anything that happens in that game can't be held against us in the court of law. But for today, we've got some fun stuff. DJ LeMahieu is forcing us to talk about him. If you haven't seen him, should the past couple weeks, he's been out of control. And a little bit of zoom out a little bit of what's going on with the Yankees' lead in the AL East and what that means historically a little bit. We'll send it around quickly. Jimmer, I'll start with you before we go to the Queen. How are you doing, bud?
I'm doing well. I cleaned the entire house today. So besides my office. My office is a mess. Cleaned the house. Got nice and sweaty. Yankees are coming on soon, which will bring us back to a normal schedule right in time for the All-Star break to throw us out of loop again. But I'm excited. And like you said, I'm excited to talk about DJ because that London trip just added to an already incredible resume that he is putting together in this 2019 campaign. So I'm excited for what KT has for us.
And, well, no better segue. KT Sharp, how you doing? And I guess, you got any thoughts from London? You know, you heard me and Jimmer bicker a little bit about it. Where are you at on London and where are you at in general?
I'm a little bit mixed on London. To me, it did really seem like more of an exhibition than a real game. I think it was partly, you know, a lot of the fanfare and all the extra stuff that kind of went into it, the build up to it, I think, as well. But and then it's hard to kind of take a lot of the stuff seriously with what you saw in those games and that ball just flying everywhere. And I think you guys are right. It really wasn't the fences that were the problem. I think it was more that turf and some of the optics, yeah. You know, with that weird white batter's eye. And then some, I guess they were talking about some of the airflow because it was meant to be a stadium for track and field. So they wanted to kind of have as little airflow as possible. But I mean, it was great because I love spreading the game to different places. You know, I want more people in the world to be able to, you know, to have baseball and everything. So hopefully that works out. But man, they really need to do some stuff about that stadium and you know, the turf and whatever. So, but overall, I enjoyed it, man. It was pretty nice. It was pretty cool to see, you know, to see the Yankees and Red Sox in the spotlight somewhere else. See how other fans were reacting.
Yeah, I think it ended up, when you walk away, it was kind of a fun event. Definitely some holes baseball-wise, but hey, we'll take our two W's and get out of there. Only baseball team to ever win a baseball game in Europe. That's a little Jakey stat to start off the episode. Katie, let's start off with better stats than that, and some of the best stats you'll find across the lead. A guy that's now being talked, it went from, wow, this guy's having a great season, to this guy is the current AL MVP going into the All-Star break. David John makes long gone DJ LeMahieu, LaMachina, whatever you want to call him. KT, he's been incredible, and it's funny, you know, more and more is starting to leak out, and we did a little bit on when we were doing some of the Yankees hard-hit balls, the exit velo and some of that. It's gone to a new level, KT, and I don't know. I know you have a little bit on what the Coors effect means, because that's obviously been a popular phrase lately, especially with Rockies fans ending up in all three of our Twitters saying we can't believe we didn't re-sign this guy, and we knew we should have. This is Rockies management at it again. Sorry, all our Rockies listeners, but Katie, where do you want to start with DJ? Do you want to go Coors effect? Do you want to go what's making it special? Where would you like to bring us?
Well, first, I kind of want to just point out that we have to remember that he was really good before. I mean, he was a really good in 2016. And, you know, granted, some of these numbers are inflated, you know, by the Coors, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But he hit 348 416, 495 in 2016, and he got MVP votes in that year. So this was no joke. And even when you look at some of his park-adjusted stats, he had a park-adjusted weighted runs created plus, that's an overall offensive, you know, stat, of 130, so 30% better than league average, which is really good. And this year he's at about 144, 44% better than league average for weighted runs created plus. So obviously doing a little bit better this year. But, man, he was good in 2016. I think people forget that. So I think that's the first thing that you want to remember. And then, you know, just one another thing I want to point out before we get started on this is that his skills are really, I mean, I hate to bring this word in because it's sort of overused now, but he's sort of a unicorn in baseball right now. If you look at what he's doing, he has elite contact skills, and he pairs that with well above average power. And I'm talking about not power. I'm talking about hitting the ball hard. Sorry, excuse me. So elite contact skills plus hitting the ball hard. That is not something that you find in most players. Because you think about guys that hit the ball super hard, like Aaron Judge, Gary Sanchez, they're going to whiff a lot, right? But this is DJ LeMahieu. He has a 87% contact rate this season and a hard hit rate of 45% and an exit velocity of 91 miles per hour. All of those are well above the league average. That contact rate is elite. So there are only 11 other guys who have a contact rate that high in the majors right now. And I was looking at guys with, like, I think 250 plate appearances. And none of them have as high a hard hit rate, 45%, as DJ. So if you kind of want to compare it, I mean, there's basically no one else like him. There are guys, you know, that are really close, like Mike Trout is really close. He's got an 86% contact rate and, you know, about a 45% hard hit rate. Justin Turner, Anthony Rendon, those are the closest comps who either have slightly lower contact rates and equal or better hard hit rates. But we're talking about somebody who has, you know, these elite skills, but I don't think people don't realize it because he's not hitting like the homers that Judge hits, or he's not Mike Trout, you know, he doesn't have that kind of cachet, but his profile is really close to what Mike Trout's is in terms of contact and hard hit skills. So I think that is sort of a natural progression to like what he's been able to do this season. And, you know, I was kind of doing a little bit of research on him, and there was actually some evidence that before last year, he changed some of his approach at the plate to become more like what he's doing this year. And so I found an article in April of last year on FanGraphs by Travis Sawchuk, in which the Rockies hitting instructor talked about how, you know, what they wanted LeMahieu to develop more pull side power because he was an extreme opposite field hitter his first few years. And I mean, he had opposite field rates of over 40%, which is just ridiculous. League average is like 23%. So, and he was hitting the ball on the ground a lot. He was hitting a ball on the ground like 55% of the time his first few seasons. So what they wanted to do is they knew he could hit the ball hard. They knew he had this great contact rate. So they wanted to develop some of that pull side power with him. So what they decided to do, and they kind of what the changes that he made, is they didn't want him to just consciously, you know, try and pull the ball more. So this wasn't any sort of like, you know, the whole launch angle. I'm going to just hit the ball hard, wait for my pitch and do that type of thing. It's basically anti-launch angle. What they tried to do is to have him move his contact point forward in front of the plate so that naturally when he swung, if he swung earlier, he'd be able to hit the ball more in front of the plate, and that would allow him to pull the ball in the air more. You know, sounds so simple.
And don't change the swing, just change your feet.
Basically, just kind of change your timing and your your setup. He's like having a stronger
scooting up on a slow pitcher.
Yes, having a stronger base and just swinging a little bit earlier to get that bat in front of the plate a little bit more, and then naturally the ball is going to pull more and it's going to go in the air more. So, you know, that's he wasn't trying to increase his launch angle or anything like that. And that actually led to a lot more power last year and pulling the ball last year more. So really that increase in pull side power happened last year when he hit 15 home runs. And he actually evened out his opposite field and pull side percentages to about 30% each. And, you know, kept going up the center about 40% of the time. So you saw some of these changes last year. So, you know, that's kind of I think that's one of the more interesting things is that this year, I mean, it's not like he's doing this whole, like, he's kind of like the anti-launch angle, you know, he's against everything that most people do when they make dramatic changes and you see these dramatic shifts in their stats. He's not like, you know, a lot of times we talked about with Glaber, who he's kind of being a little bit more passive, waiting for his pitch to come into the zone and really taking advantage that way. He's not doing that. And he's not trying to hit the ball in the air more. So I think that was probably the most interesting thing that I came across. So there's a bunch of other things, but what do you guys think about that approach? And, you know, anything that you've seen somebody do like that before?
Does he have crazy pull numbers this year? I can remember the home run versus, was it Richards or someone on the Blue Jays, where he let off the game and then Judge went oppo, but he pulled the hell out of the ball. And I think there was another home run versus Chirinos or two versus Chirinos that he went like dead center and then pulled a little bit. I'm trying to remember big hits where he pulled the ball. I can remember another double off the wall. He still very much goes to the right side.
I picture his doubles going line to line.
Yeah, that's what he is. He's line to line now. Before he was like mostly oppo. Like I said, he was about 40% oppo, 40% center, and then like 20% pull. But this year and last year, he's about 30% oppo and pull and 40% center. So you're still seeing a lot at the center. You're still seeing those hits up the center. You're still seeing a lot of oppo, but it's a lot more. But it's more pull than we've seen in the past, and I think that's a good thing.
So are you giving credence to my Jakey theory that guys like LeMahieu, Michael Brantley, these guys that it's called the old school approach now, which I think is funny, and I think we're going to end up laughing at it in a little bit, because I'll tell you what's not an old school approach. If you hit well over 300, and it's not like these guys are slapping. I mean, DJ does have extra base hit power now. I mean, he's got a nice OPS going. It's not like, I mean, DJ LeMahieu lifetime now is a .302 batting average, but he's a .770 OPS, which isn't that impressive. And I think some people might be surprised by that, especially if you've only gotten to see this DJ LeMahieu. So, I mean, and you mentioned his footwork and kind of the approach of kind of making contact at a different point. Is that where all the power is coming from? Is it kind of the, I've got another little league term, like the harder they throw, the harder it goes? Is it the fact that these guys throw 95 up now and he can still barrel them up and you get more gappers? Or, I mean, what are the connect the dots here that are, and, you know, is there credence to that theory? And I guess, is the power all tied into what you were just talking about with kind of where he's making contact?
Yeah, I think so, because and this is actually kind of what I wanted to talk about next in sort of this progression. And, you know, he's always had above the league average in terms of exit velocity and hard hit rates. He's had hard hit rates of over 40% pretty much every season since StatCast started, and exit velocity of about 91 miles per hour, you know, since 2015 when StatCast started measuring that. And what we've seen this year, though, is his hard hit rate has actually increased a little bit from last year, while his average velocity is about the same. So what he's actually doing is he's making, I think, what I would like to say, more high quality contact. So he's getting more of in that band of the upper, you know, higher exit velocities. And he's actually increased his sweet spot percentage, which we've talked about on this podcast, I think a couple times at least, in terms of hitting the ball at the optimal launch angle of like between 8 and 32 degrees. So he's increased the number of balls that he hits in that lane, in that angle as well this year compared to last year. So basically what I see is that, you know, he's got a higher rate of high quality contact, more optimizing his contact. His barrels are up. We've talked about those with Gary, you know, in terms of those are like the best types of batted balls that he can have. So he's not necessarily hitting the ball on average any harder, but he's being more efficient, I guess, with the way that he hits the ball and his swing. And that's really what you're seeing. He's hitting, you know, a few more line drives, fewer ground balls. So that's also helping him, I think. But really in terms of his batted ball profile, it's really just kind of optimizing that swing. What I kind of mentioned there.
Yeah. We have a voicemail here about DJ and what he's doing with runners in scoring position. Very interesting voicemail. The question, I'll let me play it. Are we ready for this?
Well, I kind of wanted to address that that Coors Effect thing, because I think that's something that I know a ton of people have come about.
The Coors Effect and then the reverse Coors Effect,
yeah.
Which I'm actually more fascinated with.
Yeah, so everyone's like, oh, well, you know, when we signed him, he's like, oh, well, his home road splits, they suck, you know. And so when people think about the Coors Effect, they think that, oh, well, this guy's true talent is what he does on the road because his home roads are inflated, right? But really what's happening is that, you know, you can't just, like, look at those road stats and assume that's what he's going to hit when he comes to, you know, Yankee Stadium and plays in all the other stadiums. Hitting in Colorado helps your performance. There's no doubt about that. You know, you can't deny that his numbers in Colorado, you know, are better than they would be normally. But he's also hurt on the road more than the normal hitter, more than the average hitter. Rockies hitters are hurt on the road. So their road performance goes down while their home performance goes up. So you can't assume that what they hit on the road is what they really do. Hope that makes some sense.
Well, I think the reason being because balls look so good at home that when they go on the road, they have to adjust for everything else. And they're constantly in a state of adjustment that their road numbers take a dive. We talked about this before the season. At the time, Jake wasn't a believer in it. Jake, do you believe in it now?
I believe in it to a degree. I mean, I still think it's kind of the sport of baseball. I think there's, like, I mean, even relating things to the London series that just happened, you see how little things can affect the game of baseball. I think there's something to it. I don't think you can... I wouldn't use it as a crutch.
Well, I think the most important thing is there's kind of like two big theories about what happens is that we know in Colorado, the breaking pitches, there's less movement on those. So they're constantly having to adjust back and forth between seeing breaking pitches with a lot of movement, seeing breaking pitches with not a lot of movement. And that's difficult. And the other theory is that opposing pitchers will throw more fastballs in Colorado because than they do on the road because, you know, obviously they're afraid of those breaking pitches hanging in the zone. So Rocky hitters then, there's this theory that they become more aggressive at home and less, and they adjust their aggressiveness at home to the fastballs, but then when they go on the road, they're sometimes too aggressive. So you actually do see that in them striking out more on the road than at home. And walking more, you know, walking less on the road than they do at home. So there is some evidence about that. But I think the breaking pitches thing is actually a real thing because this is the one last point that I want to make with how DJ has improved is that he's seen an incredible improvement on his ability to hammer breaking pitches. And I think that, that is perhaps the most impressive improvement that he's made, considering where he was coming from. You know, coming from an environment where he basically had no idea what the pitch was going to do, because he was going back and forth so much. So I just kind of want to throw out some of these numbers because they are pretty incredible in terms of what he's doing against breaking and off-speed pitches as well. So last year he had a 233 batting average on breaking and off-speed pitches, a 358 slugging, and a 260 wOBA on those. And those were all about league average. So it's not like he was terrible, but he was basically just about league average on breaking and off-speed pitches. Well, he killed fastballs. I mean, he's been known as basically a fastball hitter. So this year, on breaking pitches and off-speed pitches, he's hitting 333, slugging 551 with a wOBA of 383.
So if 551 slugging on breaking pitches?
Yeah. And a 333 batting average. So if you want to put those into context, that 333 batting average is the second highest in the league right now. And that those both those slugging marks and the wOBA marks are both top 15 in the league. So he's been gone from basically a league average hitter on breaking and off-speed pitches to probably a top 10, top 15 hitter in terms of what he's doing this year. And to me, you know, that's basically kind of evidence that I think that, you know, that's a really impressive improvement that he's made. This is not just luck. You know, he's really learned to hit different pitches this year. And he still has been awesome on fastballs. So basically now, like, as we've seen, there's no way to get him out.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's his weakness right now? Nothing?
He doesn't really have a weakness. I was trying to find one. You know, just kind of randomly going through splits and stuff. And there really isn't. And I think
maybe don't have any runners on base. Is he worse without runners on base? Because he's surely better with them on base.
Yes. And that will bring us to our next topic, which you want to play that wonderful voicemail?
Yeah, let me bring this up. Forget who it was from, but it's a good question.
Hey, John Boy. Hey, Jake. This is for a Sharp Stat segment or show. Question about DJ LeMahieu's ability to hit with runners in scoring position, his clutch ability. What is the all-time record, and you think it's possible for him to actually annihilate that record the way he's hitting with runners in scoring position? Thanks. Great job, everyone.
So, runners in scoring position, right now, he's been automatic. He's amazing. And, you know, some people will tell you it's just circumstance and clutch isn't real. Jake last episode said, you know, putt for fun and then putt with $100 on the line. And that's a great example of feeling the difference in the pressure of a moment. And some people can calm that and other people can't. And there's no way you can measure that with numbers. So they just say, since we can't measure with numbers, it doesn't exist. Any athlete in the world will tell you pressure moments exist and some people crumble and some people come to task and DJ comes to task. But this is a great question by this guy. What are we looking at here? Like, is he even close? I don't have any sense of relatableness to, like, what a record for total season runners in scoring position type numbers would be. I have no sense of it. Is he close to that? Is he above it? Is he well below it? What is it, Katie?
All right, so the single season batting average record for runners in scoring position, and actually this only goes back, we only have fully complete data for this going back to 1974. So I don't want to call this like an all-time record or anything.
Okay.
So,
but 74 is pretty decent.
Yeah, I mean, this is the modern era of baseball, right? You know.
It's better when they say since StatCast been invented, which is like 4
right,
years.
Right. Yeah. There are no records since, you know, whatever. But yeah, so since 1974 and, you know, looking at guys with at least 100 plate appearances with runners in scoring position, the highest one is by George Brett in 1980, and it was 469. So DJ is at 486 as we entering Tuesday. So yes, he's better than the all-time record.
And it's still very early. It'll probably cool off. Like, it will most definitely cool off, you would think, but he is a machine right now. But that's interesting to note that what he's doing right now is above the record.
Yeah. And so I kind of, you know, I think the question is, well, does he have a chance of annihilating this? So what I did is I kind of looked at some splits. I looked at some of the expected stats with StatCast. And, I mean, yes, obviously, and this should not be a surprise, but his actual numbers are a lot higher than his StatCast numbers. You know, the expected stats that we talk about here, the expected batting average, the expected slugging. So, yes, his batting average is .486. His expected batting average is .351, which is still really awesome. And his slugging is .546. His slugging is .722. That's ridiculous. And his expected slugging is .546, which is still really awesome with the runners in scoring position. So, yes, you know, the metrics say that he's going to regress, and I think he will regress somewhat. But I kind of looked at his splits, and he's hitting the ball a ton better with runners in scoring position compared to overall. So his hard hit rate is higher, his launch angle is higher, his sweet spot percentage is higher. He's hitting more line drives with runners in scoring position. He's whiffing less. His strikeout rate is 10% in runners in scoring position. It's 14% overall. So he's doing a lot of things right with runners in scoring position. So I think that we can expect him to be better. You know, I think he can sustain something over 400. I don't think he's going to sustain 46 for the rest of the season. But I think that he can sustain into the 400s. And people have done that in the past. You know, it's not ridiculous for a player to hit over 400 with runners in scoring position for an entire season.
Is it easy to find out what Yankee, like, recently has had? Any, like, last Yankee to have over 400 with runners in scoring position?
Well, the Yankee record is 428, and that's by Paul O'Neill in 97.
Nice.
So,
what year was George Brett, did you say?
1980.
So, you know, all-star, silver slugger, MVP.
Yeah, winner. I mean, that was basically a really good year for him.
Batted .390 on the season.
Yeah. So, I think that I think a DJ absolutely can probably hit over 400. So I'm looking at Paul O'Neill. And then the only other guy under over 400 for the Yankees was Mattingly in 84, who hit exactly 400.
Luis Soho.
No. Oh. Yeah. Good guess. Don Mattingly in 84 hit exactly 400 with runners in scoring position. So I think that he has a chance to reach Paul O'Neill's record. And stay above 400 because he does, like I said, he has that elite approach. He has the elite contact, and he has the above average, well above average exit velocity and hard hit rate. And those two things are going to help you out with runners in scoring position. The other thing that I think is really important to note, which is why I think he can maintain it too, you know, at least in the 400s, is that he's basically shift proof. He hasn't seen a shift since 2016. Think about that. It's been 3 years since anybody has tried to shift on him.
And they used to do crazy shifts because he was so...
Well, yes. I should have done that as he hasn't seen an infield shift since 2016. He's actually seen an outfield shift, an opposite field outfield shift.
Yeah.
He saw a couple of those. Okay. I think it was 2017. Couple of teams did that. It's really cool. You should go Google it or something like that. Check it out on StatCast.
Yeah, there's like four outfielders. He hits it to the right side. Yes. Still gets a triple.
No, but he actually hit it to the right side, and it was like perfectly in the gap, and the guy caught it on the fly. I believe that was against like the Diamondbacks or something. But it was like right where it would have been totally in the gap of like right field, center field, and the center fielder was right there. So they had like four outfielders in the outfield, and they were all shifted to that side. So you know, because of his, like what I said, his unicorn-ness, because he's shift-proof, I think that he has a chance to stay within, stay at least, stay above 400 with runners in scoring position. I don't, 469 is really good. So I don't know if he can keep that up, but you know, he's special and he's doing special things this year.
Katie, I have a question for you that, because you are incredible with stats, but I very much enjoy getting your thoughts on things, and we mentioned a lot of different things here, and you know, it's been awesome. This LeMahieu season, no matter how you look at it, is awesome. Whether you want to look analytics or raw stats, you can't pick it apart right now. I mean, we talked a little bit of Coors Effect, and by the way, I think we've got a friend out here, Drew Kreisman, who's Baseball Writers of America. He has a popular Rockies podcast. I think we should all do a Coors Effect thing one day.
Yeah.
I think that would be a lot of fun.
Well, he talked about it when he was on before the season. He was the one that was like letting us know about the reverse effect.
Yeah,
the hangover.
And I think we'd have a lot of fun with that. And I do have new forming thoughts on it, because right now it sounds like it'd be bad to be a hitter and a pitcher. But we'll come back there another time. But Katie, this offseason, we have a ton of free agents. Everyone's screaming Machado and Harper. Obviously, front office look at things differently now. You know, Jed Lowrie was a guy who I think he was either an all-star last year or he had a really good season. There was a lot of different options out there. What was the Yankees front office saying when we signed DJ LeMahieu this offseason? Were they saying, hey, if we move his point of ball contact up an inch and a half, he can be an elite hitter? Do you think they saw something in the 2016 tape that they said, we can get this out of him? I want to know, like, you have the stats to go with it, but what do you think they were saying in there?
Well, I think the reason I think one of the main reasons was because he was so versatile. I think that they wanted him for his defense first, because he could. They knew that they were going to have some. They knew they were going to have a shortage of infielders. You know, with Didi and Didi being out. And they wanted some guy who could kind of shift around. And, you know, with Tulo, they signed Tulo, but they knew they weren't. I don't think they were really banking on Tulo. that was a fun little experiment. But I think that they really wanted him because of his defensive versatility. And they knew that they were really bad in the infield on defense last year. And they knew that was one area that they wanted to improve. So I think first and foremost, I think that was what helped him. And I wouldn't be surprised if they saw those contact numbers combined with those exit velocity numbers, because we know the Yankees look at that stuff. We know they did it with Luke Voit. And they probably kind of saw the same thing that the Rockies did last year. Because I mentioned these changes were made in 2018, you know, before kind of in the 2018 offseason, before the 2018 season when he moved his point of contact forward. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Yankees saw those two things and say, hey, this guy has some hidden power. This guy is actually, he was really good at one point. He had a bad, you know, he kind of fell off the cliff a little bit in 2017 and 2018. He kind of was still, you know, had a down year as well. But, you know, I think that they kind of saw what he did in 2016. They knew it was in him. They knew that he had the ability to just, a knack for really hitting the ball and putting wood, you know, putting the barrel to the ball. And they knew he could hit the ball hard and that they felt like that he was going to have a lot more success, you know, this year. So we saw it with Luke Voit. And I think this is just another example of the Yankees analytics kind of finding that hidden gem.
And go analytics, go.
Speaking of those Yankees analytics a little bit, and the LeMahieu stuff is awesome. And I mean, as a person that loves looking at box scores or Baseball Reference or anything, DJ LeMahieu right now is 5 off of his season high RBIs in a season. He is 3 away from his career high in home runs, which was last year in 128 games, even though, you know, some of his other peripheral stats are down. So it's been an incredible watch. And I think we're going to end up complimenting that same Yankees front office a little more. And I think we're going to kick it off with another voicemail, Jamalope.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
John Boy, Jake, it's Kyle from California. I had a question for Katie. Maybe you guys can help me answer it. I'm looking at the standings, and the Red Sox are 10 games back at the first place. Is there a way to look at the percentages of teams that can come back from 10 games down? Thanks, guys.
I thought it was interesting. We can peacock a little. Yanks are 10 games up on the Sox.
It's actually 11 now.
11, yeah. But how bad is that for the Red Sox? What's the likelihood that they could come back? Has a team ever come back? Have the Red Sox ever come back? What's going on? What are some stats surrounding this lead or dividend the Sox have put themselves in?
All right. So let's get to the numbers here. Come on. No messing around here. So like I said, what I did is I looked at – I actually wanted to kind of figure out, like, so the Yankees are winning on July 1st. They're leading the division on July 1st. You know, what does that actually mean? You know, does this mean that they have a really good chance of kind of maintaining their division lead and winning the AL East, which is, I think, was the main goal for this team coming into the season because of just how awful we've seen the wild card be the past couple of years. So I went back to the wild card, the start of the wild card era, 1995, and I looked at all the teams that were in first place on entering July 1st, so when you woke up on July 1st, and then where they finished at the end of the season. So what I found is that 65% of the teams that were leading or tied for the division lead on July 1st ended up winning their division going back to 1995. So two out of three, basically two-thirds of the teams were leading their division. The other interesting thing I found was that of the 24 World Series winners, 16 of them were leading on the division. So there's a good chance that the team that is leading in division right now is going to be hoisting the trophy at the end of the season. Hopefully that'll be the Yankees. But those numbers were actually pretty surprising to me because, I mean, basically, what, 3 months into the season, and we can predict like two-thirds of the teams that are going to be winning their division at this point.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Yeah, it is pretty nuts. And actually, the last World Series winner that was not leading their division on July 1st was the Giants in 2010.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Shit. So every World Series winner, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018.
Yeah.
All were leading their division by the break?
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And I feel like we jinxed everything.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you can blame it on me.
Jinx squad.
To be fair, we are one of six teams leading their division.
Right. Yeah. So there's like, it's not like the Yankees are the only team that is in this pool. Like there's six teams every year in this pool that can win, you know? That are leading their divisions.
But it is crazy. But that still is nuts that, like, I don't know, last year when the Red Sox were winning their division at the All-Star break, we weren't that far behind. And I was like, well, we can easily catch up. That happens all the time. But apparently it doesn't.
We didn't. And only, I think it was, I closed my spreadsheet on that one. But I think there was only one team that was not leading the division last year on July 1st, it ended up winning. And I believe it was the Dodgers. Yeah, it was the Dodgers last year. Remember they got off to that horrible start. So they had to play catch up a lot most of the season. I think they ended up leading, you know, at the All-Star break or something. And then, you know, went on that huge run at the end of the season. But, so yeah, and then the next thing I wanted to do was kind of look at like, well, how safe is our lead really? So at this point on July, when we woke up on July 1st, we were actually 7 ahead of the Rays, 7 games ahead. So there were only 4 teams that have overcome deficits of at least 7 games on July 1st to then win the division. Those were the 2003 A's. They had a 7-game deficit. They ended up winning the AL West. The 2006 Twins, they were down 11 games. Yikes. Remember that White Sox Twins debacle? That was the Tigers, right? Was it Tigers? Or White Sox who collapsed? No, the White Sox.
I'm blanking.
And then the 2007 Cubs were 7.5 back, and they ended up winning. And then our favorite team, the 2012 A's, were 13 back. If you guys remember, they just went on that humongous, they had a 20-game win streak, I think that was the year.
Moneyball year?
No, not the Moneyball year. Or no, was that the Moneyball year? 2012? No. That was way before. I don't know if they went on that 20-game win streak, but they were 13 back.
Moneyball year, that 2012 was when they played the wild card, right? Or no, the ALDS, it was Sonny Gray versus Verlander. It was a crazy series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, they were 13 back on July 1st. So those are four teams that overcame 7-game deficits to win the division. And you notice that only two of those were 11 or more games, which is what the Red Sox are back as of July 1st. And then the other thing I looked at was, so then I found a note, I believe it was from the Live Sports Bureau, that said that the largest deficit that the Red Sox have ever overcome to win a division is 10 games. And that was in 1988.
So they'd be making history.
For their franchise, they would be making history. And pretty rare, though, during the wild card era, when only two teams have done it in the past, 25 years.
We are the sport. Baseball is a sport where anything can happen. But bottom line, it seems like, surprise, surprise, being this far ahead in our own division at the half is a good thing.
Yes, Yankee fans, it is a good thing that we are doing this well.
Awesome. I'm excited about that. That division winner. If you told me, the World Series, you gave me a later date, the end of July, end of August.
Yeah.
That's of course. But the All-Star break, I feel like we see swings in the standings all the time. The last 8 World Series winners were leading their division by the break. That's kind of crazy to me.
It's July 1st, so not technically not the All-Star break, but yeah.
Well, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Little even better, actually. Even crazier, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's before that, yeah.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. Using that logic. Yeah, I'm trying to bring up the standings right now. Maybe this year's a bad example, but I mean the 3 AL Astros have a 6.5 game lead on the Rangers, who nobody was really in on. I guess the Twins and the Indians is one to watch if the Indians could find some magic, but they have an 8 game lead right now. And then in the National League, the only close lead in baseball right now is the Brewers-Cubs. They're a game apart. Braves have a 5.5 game lead, and the Dodgers already have a 12 spot in the West. So, that's some little baseball standings magic there. Sharp stat standings. Leave that in the comments and reviews. Katie, I think, is it that magical time of the show? Sharp stat of the week?
Sharp stat of the week.
Do you have 3 for us? Are you spoiling us?
I did. I couldn't choose because I tweeted.
Wow.
So I was looking at, what we did in June, and there was just, I found some historical performances in June that just kind of wowed me, that I don't think people realized how hot a couple of these players were in June. Well, maybe you did, but you didn't just realize to the extent of how hot, how good these 3 players were in June. So I'll start off with the first one, and it's our favorite little baby boy, Gleyber Torres, and he had a 462 on-base percentage in June. That's really good. We talked about his improvements on our last show, I believe it was, walking a lot more and just being a lot more disciplined and everything. We talked about his power, but we didn't really talk about his on-base percentage. So this 462 on-base percentage, it's the third highest in any calendar month for a Yankee age 22 or younger. with at least 60 plate appearances in that month. Third highest. The guys ahead of him, Joe DiMaggio had a 504 OBP in July 1937, and Charlie Keller had a 543 OBP in August 1939. So he's behind Joe DiMaggio and Charlie Keller, who are very good players, in case you guys didn't know. Anybody not aware of Yankees history, those are two icons. joking there, obviously. So that's our sharp stat number one. Go Glaber. Yeah. And then we all know how good Chad has been. Chad Green, our newest favorite reliever. So what I did is I looked at his numbers and I'm like, a couple things stood out to me. I'm like, wow. So we've talked about maybe on this podcast about fielding independent pitching, which it looks at basically what things are a pitcher does that are independent of the defense behind him. So that really his defenders can't control, that he basically controls by himself or at least has more control over than other things like hits and runs scored, right? And those three things are walks, strikeouts, and home runs. So three things that a pitcher kind of has reasonable control over what happens. So in June, Chad Green had 20 strikeouts, one walk, and no homers allowed. And the only other Yankee pitcher to have those numbers, so at least 20 strikeouts, one walk or fewer, and no home runs in a calendar month, I bet you guys can probably guess. It's Mariano Rivera.
Ramiro Mendoza.
Oh, close. No, it's the great same bullpen. The great Mariano, and he did it twice. He did it in September 1996 and he did it in July 2005. So
saying he did it twice.
I know.
Mariano.
Yeah.
He did.
Oh, by the way, he did do it twice, but this is very rare.
And one of those was in September, you know, inarguably one of like, you know, during that pennant in 1996 when the Yankees were trying to close out that pennant there. So yeah, he's good.
Katie, I've got a butter knife on Chad Green that I think I said it on the podcast, but I need to say it to you because I feel like Jimmy didn't appreciate it enough and I like being appreciated. You know that. Chad's last 15 innings, 11 games, 15 innings, 24 strikeouts, 0.6 ERA. Sure. Katie, his BABIP in that time period is 417.
Are you kidding?
So he's pitched to a 0.6 ERA, 0.6.
Yeah. Like, how's that? Like,
with
one run?
417 BABIP.
Yeah, it's like one run allowed, I think.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And if guys are batting the ball in play, they're hitting that 417.
Yeah, they're going to get a hit, you know. But the thing is, probably, he doesn't allow that many balls in play.
Exactly. Because
he's striking out everybody. Oh, it's awesome. That's a great note. That BABIP note is great.
I feel appreciated now. Thank you, Katie.
All right.
Jake has butter knife stat off.
Okay, wait. All right, before we end, you know, I got one more sharp stat, and it has to be about DJ LeMahieu. You knew it. You knew it was coming. So his June, we know, was pretty ridiculous. He had 45 hits and 29 runs batted in, RBIs, in June. That seems good. So, the last Yankee, let me talk about this, the last Yankee to have that many hits, so at least 45 hits, and that many RBIs, so at least 29 RBIs in any calendar month, was Mickey Mantle in May of 1956. And if you remember, Mickey Mantle went on to win the MVP and the Triple Crown that year. Now, I'm not saying that obviously, DJ's gonna do that, but that was a pretty good year.
No, that's what George Brett did in 1980 as well.
Oh yeah, all right. Oh my gosh, Jesus! All right, well, there you go.
I ended up on. I was clicking through George Brett's 1980 season.
Yeah.
Right, and then I ended up on this YouTube video. Maybe I'll send you guys the link in the chat. I'm gonna post this on Twitter. Watch this, Jake. I want to get your reaction. It's George Brett, Game 3 of the 1980 World Series, his first at-bat of the game, facing a pitcher named Dick Ruthven. Dick Ruthven. And they're like 29. Ruthven's 29 years old. George Brett is, I don't know how old he was in 1980, probably pretty young. He was 27. So 27-year-old versus 29-year-old home run in the World Series. And it looks like two old men playing the slowest version of baseball I've ever seen. Do you watch?
I was wondering where you were going with it. Yeah, they both have baby faces, which has thrown me off. But yeah, it's
the pitch looks like it's 40 miles per hour, and the swing looks like a practice golf swing. I was like, what is this version of baseball?
don't throw low and into a lefty. That's rule number one.
Katie, were you able to pull that up?
I don't have the chat. I don't know what I do. I'm on my phone, my mobile phone.
Well, I'm
going to
post it and say, look at these late 20-year-olds. They look
I don't have that chat
years
thing.
Old. That looks like how Paul O'Neill swinging in the old timers day.
Yeah, that pitch looked oddly slow. Yeah, and I think, be ready for a John Boy George Brett clip coming up. And Katie, I think, I don't know if it's the cherry on top or if we go around the horn again. I think Paulie O said this in the booth the other day, and it's just part of the allure of the Yankees is that anytime someone does something special, whether it's just for a month or a week, you go, oh, yeah, the last Yankee to do that, Lou Gehrig, Roger Maris, Babe Ruth. And that really is kind of a special part of the organization that I don't think I fully understood until Paul said that recently. I understood, like, wearing the pinstripes, Babe Ruth, and obviously all of that. But I guess it's kind of cool. You put together a few two good weeks, and it's like, wow, Cameron Maben, you just did this for the first time since Lou Gehrig. It's like, damn, that's something you keep forever.
Yeah, I think that we're...
Nice being a Yankee.
We're spoiled, you know? And, you know, I think I'm a little bit spoiled, too, because, you know, obviously you guys know and everybody knows on Twitter, I like to tweet out a lot of historical stats. And I feel spoiled that I get to compare, you know, these present day guys, DJ, Glaber, Chad, to not just like the greatest Yankees, but like the greatest players in Major League history, just because we have that heritage and everything. So, Thank God for making me a Yankee. Did I just butcher that Lou Gehrig line, or what? I'm sorry, but yes.
You got it. We'll get that in post. Anything else, guys? Jimmer, Kate?
I think that's all. Go Yanks! I'm excited to get back to normal Yankee baseball.
Yeah. Here.
George Brett was an All-Star like 15 years in a row.
He
was pretty good.
Look at this. From 1974 on, listen to this run. Third in Rookie of the Year, 11th in MVP, All-Star second in MVP, All-Star 13th in MVP, All-Star 19th in MVP, All-Star third in MVP, All-Star MVP, All-Star MVP 27th, All-Star MVP 20th, All-Star, All-Star second in MVP voting, All-Star, All-Star 12th in MVP voting, nothing. Suck at 1989, terrible year, and then MVP 7th in 1990. George Brett was good, huh?
Yeah.
George Brett was good. Welcome to Talking Yanks.
He was good even when he didn't use pine tar, right?
Yeah.
Boom.
16 out of his 20 years in the league, he was an all-star, or got MVP voting. Nuts.
Yeah.
That's great. Maybe I'll ask my grandma about it, but for now, we'll just have her tell ya.
Go Yankees.